by the various wisdom traditions throughout the ages, and are even in line with modern discoveries in physics. So there are many movements that are pointing towards a new understanding of consciousness and mind. And we hope to bring that out more in the conference.
Yeah, Blavatsky was remarkable in how she recognized what these central issues were, like over a century ago. Like when I read The Secret Doctrine, she talks about the issues of evolution versus creation, and she talks about the issues of consciousness and irreducibility of mind. She talked about all these things over a century ago, and then a century later, we've been like sleepwalkers, and we finally kind of meet dead ends, and then we can turn back to her work now, I think, to provide new insights into solving these.
Yes, as you're saying, in her main work, The Secret Doctrine, at least one-third of it is devoted to the scientific theories of the day, considering evolution, the nature of the universe, psychology, physics, chemistry, and of course, in light of those teachings, she compared that with the philosophy and teachings of theosophy. So she recognized that in our time, the scientific mode of approaching truth is a predominant one.
I so like the way that Blavatsky, like, endorsed science. Like, she was totally scientific. She just was arguing that the materialist perspective was wrong. It wasn't that she was against science, real science. I know in The Secret Doctrine that she says, at one point she says, any physics carried far enough has to lead to metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. So she had the greatest respect for true scientists, those that use the scientific method to explore all the different departments of nature. She had no contention with the facts accumulated by science. Where she would question, as did other scientists of the day, was where those theories began to encroach into the nature of mind and consciousness, and the scientists tried to reduce phenomena relating to those issues primarily to matter and physical properties.
Yeah.
So she did not deny the physical facts of nature, but said there are aspects of our lives that cannot be reduced to mere molecules and atoms.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this quote from The Secret Doctrine. She wrote, "The theosophists are the first to recognize the intrinsic value of science, but when its high priests resolve consciousness into a secretion from the gray matter of the brain and everything else in nature into a mode of motion, we protest against the doctrine as being unphilosophical, self-contradictory, and simply absurd. From a scientific point of view, as so much and even more than from the occult aspect of the esoteric knowledge." So that kind of captures those points, like her endorsement of science, but just rebelling against the limitations of that paradigm.
And it's true that even scientists today, from different disciplines, physics, psychology, would echo the same idea.
Yeah,
that consciousness and mind and various phenomena connected with it cannot be merely explained on the basis of molecules and matter, and any attempt to do so fails short and just doesn't go with the phenomena that are observed.
Yeah, we always run into those enigmas. We run into enigmas, things we can't explain that show us, which are really clues that there has to be a deeper reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then Blavatsky provided such a remarkable teaching about the complexity of creation. And
well, in a sense, Stephen, it's Jim Moffat. I'm a regular on here with Chris. In a sense, it's like the history of 20th century physics really vindicates her vision, in the sense that, you know, the famous quotes from Sir James Jeans, that the more we study the universe, the more it seems like a great thought than a great machine. Or Sir Arthur Eddington saying that the stuff of the universe is mind stuff. or Eugene Wigner saying that there isn't any aspect of modern physics that doesn't demand some acknowledgement of consciousness, and right up to the contemporary research in which, you know, it's just the duality of matter and energy has been replaced by the trinity of matter, energy, and information. So it's almost as if everything that she said, you know, 120 years ago has been vindicated by physical science itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she even then further provides an alternate model I think you can take the secret doctrine and investigate certain propositions in that. Like the skeptics always say, paranormal phenomena, there's no model to explain them or no explanatory system. But really, there are many, many ideas in Blavatsky which articulates a model of these processes. So it's not just saying God did it, but it's actually explaining the mechanisms of divine creation.
Yes, if we go back to the previous thoughts there on modern physics and look at the introduction of quantum theory and what it tells us about the nature of reality and the nature of mind, and basically the underlying message there is that the observer is the reality and determines all the possibilities and collapses them into the one that is observed. There are many different possibilities, and the one that we view and understand to be real for us is pretty much determined by our minds, the influence of our minds on our observations.
Yeah.
So that's a strong statement about how important consciousness is. It's a central aspect of our universe. It's not a mere outcome of matter. So any theory of psychology today would have to take in quantum theory as a consideration and not Newtonian physics. Unfortunately, most theories today in psychology and neuropsychology work on the model of Newtonian physics and completely missed the boat when it comes to quantum material, quantum mechanics. All the interactions in the brain, for example, taking place at the atomic and molecular level are guided by quantum physics, not by Newton's three laws
of motion.
So if we take that into consideration, no theory of mind can ignore quantum theory. And the basic idea with the quantum theory today is that what we view is really a chaos of particles and possibilities, and it is the mind and the way it perceives that gives us any kind of sense of objective reality. Well, this is a basic teaching of all the different wisdom traditions, and certainly one of the basic tenets of theosophy, that what is real in ourselves is within and is our power to perceive. And much of what we consider real in our personalities and in our environment is a passing phenomenon and is not enduring. So more and more of those ideas are becoming accepted and certainly prevalent in scientific thinking today.
Yeah. I know there's one quote I love from The Secret Doctrine. Blavatsky talks about the nature of space, and at one point she says that there are countless beings and other realms and dimensions within our own space, however imperceptible they are to ourselves. But there's all these other worlds within our own space, but what it essentially does is it provides a holographic model that you can have all these interpenetrating dimensions within the same space.
And once again, we cannot help but listen to those ideas and realize how close our modern physics has come to that. We refer to quantum theory, but basically anyone who studies and understands the current quantum concepts realizes that they teach that matter is ultimately not a solid substance.
No.
It's as much energy and matter together, and it adds new dimensions to nature, this whole idea of string theory and string ideas in quantum theory add many mental dimensions beyond the ones we experience. So this whole idea that there's more to life, more to even physical life, than we can perceive with our senses is one that's coming again.
It's interesting also, you mentioned, like often people talk about Newtonian physics, but it's interesting also that Newton actually wrote 500,000 words on alchemy, and Newton himself regarded space as God's sensorium, that God, in a way, experiences through space itself, which I see as perfectly compatible with Blavatsky's view that everything is within this field of what she calls the eternal parent space, or Newton would call an absolute space. So even in a way, when we think of Newtonian physics, in a way it's a modern misinterpretation of what Newton actually said in aspects. Like, we take his laws of motion and think, oh, he just believed in the material universe of particles bumping around in empty space. But he didn't at all. He regarded space as God's sensorium.
He even had
when we hear that word sensorium or sensation, it implies a sensing of substance or different degrees of substance, and it's the whole ancient idea which Newton was acquainted, because he was a student of mysticism. He had studied the works of Jacob Burma and himself was very much interested in astrology, but the whole idea that space is a fullness, a plenum is the ancient term, not a vacuum. And our current advances in astrophysics, looking into the mysteries of dark matter and the fullness of space, sort of echo these ancient teachings. So it's a very exciting time, no doubt, because we see more and more discoveries that seem to remind us that in ancient times, and ancient thinkers, they had ways of detecting the nature of the universe that we seem to have lost in our dependency on physical experimentation and physical instruments.
It's funny when we think of the materialist argument, where they say, "I believe in what I can see," as they kick a rock, like, you know, they believe in material substance. But modern science itself so totally belies that. The rock is really a shadow, and it's composed of particles which are all waves of probability, and I mean, if you penetrate into the rock, it disappears itself into nothingness, essentially.
That's right.
There's no essential building block. The ultimate irony of 20th century physics is that the search for the elementary building block showed that there is none. It's really a web of information and relationship, and that there's no thing. Like, there's no little, you know, the final billiard ball doesn't exist on any level. That's, you know, counterintuitive, and it's counter to the Newtonian worldview.
It's interesting, though, Jim, that also Blavatsky sees, in a way, that the one element that is perfect that is permanent, is the zero-point Leia center.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, but the zero-point Leia center is unmanifested.
Right.
So the element is permanent in the unmanifest condition, which is like a bizarre kind of, I mean, it makes sense in terms of modern science, that concept.
Yeah, can I just ask a question? This is a real opportunity for me, and this is something that interests me greatly, and it goes back to something you mentioned earlier, Chris, when you were talking about Blavatsky's views about all these other beings and being present in space, and but they're not manifest to us. And given that we've got a clinical psychologist and a psychiatrist on the line at this moment, here's a question I have. I remember years ago reading a book by a guy named Wilson Van Dusen, who I believe is a psychiatrist and a student of Swedenborg, and he gave a paranoid schizophrenic, who was hallucinating, he tried to talk to the hallucination. He didn't see the hallucination as being a product of this person's disordered mind, but rather that this person was perceiving a being from another dimension, and he tried to communicate through the paranoid schizophrenic. Do either of you believe that when people hallucinate, you know, in psychiatric terms, that they're actually seeing something that is real, or do you just see it as like being like that these are products of some sort of malfunctioning of their consciousness or their you know, whether it's their brain or whatever? What's your views on this?
I'll yield to Stephen here first. And
well, from the theosophical perspective, there are three kinds of sight that we can witness. One, of course, is the one we're familiar with, where objects transmit light to our eyes, and we perceive them objectively through the brain and the various sensory centers in the brain. It is also possible for an individual to use their psychic senses and detect impressions of thoughts and feelings and perhaps the influences of other kinds of non-material beings using their own inner senses. And this of course is what Swedenborg was able to do. He was able to use his psychic senses and sense a fire that was taking place in Stockholm, 40 miles away at that time. He could not see the fire physically, but knew it was occurring. And the third kind would be where the brain itself, through some disorder, physically projects an image outward, and it is perceived objectively, but its origin is in the disordered function of the brain. So it really would depend on the individual whether the particular hallucinatory experience was the result of a disorganized brain or was in fact a psychic experience, because psychic phenomenon can occur in a way in which we might see, hear, touch, feel experiences on other planes of being.
Yeah.
We think that would give some a broad outline of how one might begin to approach.
And I would agree. I mean, I think often people who are schizophrenic do experience paranormal experiences. Right. I remember an account of like one paranoid schizophrenic being able to read people's thoughts. I think that's quite possible. I think sometimes in these dissociated states or states splitting or whatever might be involved, I think they can manifest psychical, like hear people's thoughts or sense things about them and so on.
And certainly in my clinical experience with patients over the years, there are some who are paranoid in the conventional sense, and there are some who are psychic. And it works the other way around, too. Some are psychic but never get paranoid. So there are two things, two phenomena going on here.
Yeah. There can be such a complexity of factors. Like, I think it's very interesting, the evidence demonstrating how sometimes phobias or irrational fears and such seem not to be derived from a person's experience in this life, but actually seem to be derived from a past life. Like Ian Stevenson talks about this.
Ian Stevenson, of course, passed away this year, but he led the
he'll be back.
Group down. Excuse me?
I said he'll be back.
He'll be back. He led the research group in University of Virginia, Department of Psychiatry, that looks particularly at these phenomena, near-death experiences, and also memory of past lives. And there was a particular group, hundreds of cases, actually, he coordinated and studied of children who, from a very early age, seemed to be able to remember quite clearly the details of previous lives, and in many cases they could actually confirm the reports that were given. And in some of these, in a number of these cases, the way in which the person in the previous life had died very much influenced the psychological state of the child who was reporting it in current life. So as the child grew up, they might forget the memories of their previous life as reported, but the fear if the person they had reported about in a previous life had drowned, they might continue to carry that fear of water and of drowning well into their adult life, even though they no longer remembered the details of their previous lives.
Yeah.
So there's a number of cases like that over and over again that seem to suggest that this whole subject of memory goes way beyond just attributing it to the brain.
Yeah.
There seems to be a record of memory not only in the brain but also in the thinker, the mind being, as well as in other more interior and invisible departments of nature.
One year I worked at Ohio State Medical Center, and I worked with this young man who was schizophrenic, and he was obsessed with the Civil War. And the problem we were facing in the hospital was that he refused to eat. And I remember at the time I was so struck of the inexplicable nature of his illness, and to me it was like clearly evident that somehow this related to what I thought were past life memories of being in the Civil War, perhaps being starved, perhaps starving someone else, but somehow there was some mechanism, some process there that we couldn't understand. I think often people's interests reflect their past life experiences, like a particular person might be obsessed with, say, Egypt, or you know, Sumerian times, or some other period in history, and I think often our own interests in periods or places on Earth really reflect these deep subconscious memories that we can't, which are below our awareness,
yeah,
that kind of guide our interests and such.
It's interesting that in that light, Chris, the book that Jonathan Cott wrote called The Search for Om Seti, which is about this woman in England, Dorothy Eady, who I think in about the early part of the 20th century, maybe 1905, somewhere around there, when she was a child, she fell down the stairs, hit her head, and had a near-death experience, was revived. And when she awoke, she cried about wanting to go home. And her parents assured her that she was home, but she kept insisting that she wanted to go home. And then shortly thereafter, she lived in London, and she went to the British Museum and went into the Egypt rooms in the British Museum, and had this unbelievable attraction to all things Egyptian. And what happened was that she had recalled being a palace virgin in the court of one of the pharaohs at Abydos in Egypt in I don't know, you know, thousands of years before. And she developed this incredible interest in Egypt, moved to Egypt, married an Egyptian, settled in Abydos, and was able to recall when archaeologists were excavating the ruins there, was able to recall details before they'd even uncovered them, which proved to be accurate. So, you know, her injury in childhood somehow made this connection with her past life and was subsequently verified. And like this became an obsession with Egypt, you know, and this wanting to go home.
Yeah, wow.
It's an incredible story, actually, and as best you can tell, it, you know, was verified. It's I think it ranks with the cases of me and Stevenson in terms of, you know, it's really well documented, and seems like the most plausible explanation is that somehow this person did recall a past life.
Yeah, sometimes it's like reincarnation is the most feasible explanation. Otherwise, these things are inexplicable. Not that that really explains it, because it still leaves us, what is the mechanism of that, and what is the mechanism of past life memory?
Yeah, because I mean...
I wonder, Stephen, if you have any comments on, like, what Blavatsky might have said about, could maybe comment on the Akashic record, or how did she see a person as having access to past life memory?
Well, in terms of memory, from the theosophical perspective, of course, there are different classes or kinds of memory. There's what we might call associative memory, when you hear a sound and it reminds you of something you did years ago. And then, of course, there's recollection, where you actually are trying to recall a certain fact or something you did a few days or a few months ago. Well, that kind of memory does very much depend on the healthy functioning of the brain. And any kind of disease process or injury that would interfere with brain function could interfere with that kind of associative memory or power of recollection. But the kind of memory, what could be called soul memory or reminiscence, that would have any indication of being brought over from a previous life, would be that accumulated wisdom or knowledge that we've gained from previous experience. So she would, of course, say that very often, if one had a child or a poet, an individual had a very strong memory of a previous life, it could very well be from that individual past life, but there could be other reasons they're getting that strong impression. It could be a psychic phenomenon or picking up information, as you suggested, from either the astral light or the Akashic records. But the kind of wisdom that we might bring forth, accumulated knowledge and wisdom, was more indicative of memory of past lives. So a person who might be obsessed with Egypt, but in addition would have a tremendous insight into the culture, an understanding of the language, and a knowledge of Egypt that they could not have gained in this life by any other experience, would be more indicative of knowledge coming over from previous lives.
Yeah.
That sort of accumulated soul wisdom.
Yeah. You mentioned, Stephen, I don't want to take us afield a bit, but I'm interested in, Blavatsky differentiates the astral light from the ether. The deeper ether is like the seven-skinned eternal parent space. Is the astral light the ether of, like, the solar system? Like a lower-level ether?
The way it's explained in theosophy is that substance differentiates, like everything else in the universe, in a gradual way, according to a sevenfold differentiation, just as there is a sevenfold differentiation in the musical scale or in the spectrum of light. Substance itself differentiates from the most etheric spiritual substance we might want to consider to the most objective, gross, tangible substance. And the name given to that highest degree of manifested substance that differentiates is Akasha. And in it are stored the highest impressions, spiritual, of a human being or humanity collectively. Because of its nature, it is receptive to those particular influences. But as it differentiates, becomes more dense and gross, its quality changes, and on each different plane, in each different differentiated state of that substance, it's given a different qualification. So on a lower state, it might be called ether. And then in the next lower state, and of course there are different degrees, it is called the astral substance, and that is the substance that's just beyond what we call physical gross matter. So these represent different states and planes and differentiations of that one eternal substance principle.
Yeah. I guess the astral realm is seen as a conjunction of, is it kama manas? Is that how you desire and thought, like on a lower level?
The astral substance might be the hall of mirrors or the recording sensitive plate of all our lowest impressions.
Yeah, our lower desire
feeling,
nature.
Yes, more. It's the closest to the earthly substance in that degree.
Yeah.
And it is electrical magnetic in nature, and its impressions are of a lower nature. This is why when an individual might be very psychic or sensitive, they might experience impressions that are very frightening to them, or hear things that are very frightening to them, and in their minds interpret them as voices or visions that seem very real to them, and so we call it a hallucination, but its origin is in a psychic perception of an impression made in the astral light, this astral substance.
Yeah. I wondered, just to bring up another, I'm interested in Blavatsky's view of our time period historically in terms of cycles, and maybe you might comment on that, Stephen?
Well, it depends what you mean by our time period.
The century to follow Blavatsky. What did Blavatsky foresee in terms of...
The 20th century, our time period?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or 21st century we're moving into.
Okay.
We have moved into.
One of the central teachings in theosophy is this idea of cycles or periodicity. Everything in nature has its cycle of activity and rest. And cycles even influence human evolution. And almost as a clock, the hands pass through the hours of a clock, and we can witness changes in our activities during the day that seem to follow the sequence of hours on a clock. The various stages of development in human nature can also be understood in terms of periods of time. And in terms of these cycles, in her writings, we see that towards the end of the 19th century, the year 1897, three huge cycles seem to coincide. And whenever there's a coinciding of cycles, it marks very important times for humanity. One was the last 25 years of every 100-year cycle. One was the messianic cycle, which is a 2100-year cycle within the larger 25,000-year cycle. And
2100 years, that is. So
2100 years, we're representing the movement of in the signs of the zodiac from the Pisces into Aquarius.
So I guess if we went back, like Christ was just over 2,000 years ago, so it's like as the Piscean Age ends and we move into Aquarius.
Right. And the other cycle was the first 5,000 years of the Kali Yuga, which is a Hindu cycle, came to the end. And she says as a result of that, we would see very interesting things in our time. One would be that there would be a change, revolutionary change, in just about every aspect of our life. Tremendous challenging and falling down of various institutions and science, religion, philosophy, tremendous political upheavals, and there would also be equally changes in the earth, more cataclysmic type activity, not drastic cataclysms that would destroy entire civilizations, but we would see in the Earth itself upheaval that would seem to match the various revolutionary changes going on in the human condition as well.
Yeah.
She also said it was, so this was a time of transition with tremendous change and challenging of the old ways and beginning development of new ways of thinking. She also said it was a time when the psychic nature, particularly in the West, would become more and more predominant. And certainly this would show itself not only in interest and psychic phenomenon, but also an increase in diseases of the mind as well. So that's how our particular time is affected by these cycles in that way. And, of course, in the larger picture, it's all moving towards a time when here in the West there will be a development of human nature along spiritual, psychic, and physical realms that will produce a more advanced kind of human nature than we have now. So the outlook is, even though it's very chaotic now, is all preparatory of a progress for human beings. So it's very
like hopefully breaking through to like a new world and
a new world, but one that's continuing compared to the one we have now, it will be new and an advancement. But of course, after time, there will be advances beyond that. This whole period of evolution for humanity goes back much further than our current science recognizes, and will continue for ages to come.
I mean, Blavatsky talked about the Lemurian, like the round den and the Atlanteans, and I mean, she gives this occult history of the world, I mean, substantially different than modern science. Do you know how she takes our life on Earth back, like, millions of years, I think, doesn't she, Odin? Stephen?
In the teachings that she gives out, which are based on records of ancient civilizations that have been recorded, she states that thinking humanity, as we recognize humanity in the dual-sexed form, self-conscious thinking being, can be traced back 18 million years. And the Lemurian civilization or race that you referred to was predominant at that time. The Atlantean races were later. And that would be the fourth, which we very often refer to as the fourth root race in this great cycle.
The Atlanteans were?
The Atlanteans were the fourth, yes.
Oh, okay. And we're said to be the...
We're in the fifth root race. Yeah.
Fifth root race, yeah.
The ones that followed the destruction of Atlantis.
Did she claim
But yet, the main idea is that as souls, as thinkers, evolving through many, many incarnations, we were those Atlanteans.
Yeah.
And so we bring forth in our subconscious memory many of the ideas, tendencies, faults, strengths into our modern times, and with what's been accumulated naturally through human progress, we add to it our own experience from the past. So we can see echoes in our modern times of issues and tendencies that were very prevalent in those ancient races as well. And that becomes more apparent to one as they become a deeper student of this philosophy.
Jim, do you have something you want to ask?
The question I had was, did she claim that there were written records of this, or was this information that she had obtained through either oral tuition or through psychic archaeology, or how exactly did she come to this knowledge?
Well, if we go by what she says, she said that she had the acquaintance of wise human beings. They have been given different names in different times, different traditions. She referred to them sometimes as Mahatmas or elder brothers or great souls or the masters of wisdom. But that these individuals, one of their tasks is to preserve the ancient wisdom and preserve the records of ancient civilizations, because according to the teachings of Theosophy, there have been periodical destructions and cataclysms that have wiped away many great civilizations. And so the records of the achievements of those civilizations and the events of those times have been preserved. So what she was giving out was portions of that accumulated wisdom and record that is actually preserved to this day in various caves and temples and crypts in various parts of the world, and is held there for a time, she says, when it can be given out in more detail. And much of her work is, in the Secret Doctrine, of course, is a presentation of these ancient records.
Where do you stand on the issue of the sources of Blavatsky's teaching? Do you believe that the Mahatmas, that the masters that she was in contact with were real people or were real intelligences? Or do you believe, like K. Paul Johnson suggests, that, you know, she disguised the identity of historical figures with whom she interacted in her travels and in her researches, and then she disguised them as these masters? Do you believe in the reality of the masters themselves, or do you think that Johnson's on the right track with his interpretation?
We would say that if we examine all the evidence that she gave and others have given, is that that the sources that of her information did come from wise human beings. For one thing, great philosophers and sages of the past in the East and West have referred to these great beings. Blavatsky wasn't the only one. And knowledge of their schools and their system was also known and taught. There were the mystery schools of ancient Greece and mystery schools in Egypt. And they had their adepts and hierophants who gave out knowledge and had great powers and understanding of nature. So we certainly have a long line of written record and tradition that supports what she says about the real existence of these beings. Plus, if we follow the lines of evolution and we see a progress of intelligence and form from the very lowest mineral, vegetable, animal, and human life, why assume that in this vast time of evolution on this planet that everything stops with humanity as we see it now? With the great cycles of time and possibility for human growth, it is certainly possible in light of evolution that individuals could have reached higher degrees of perfection in ancient times, and still do today. So just as there are geniuses in various academic and artistic fields, they may not be common, and their abilities may be quite astounding and rare, yet they still exist. So too there can be true geniuses in the science of life and the art of living, these so-called great souls and adepts. So if we start with this idea of reincarnation and the permanence of consciousness and mind, then there certainly has been enough opportunity for human beings to evolve to very high states and from time to time give out their accumulated wisdom. So it certainly makes sense to me that what she said is, in fact, the reality of the situation.
Yeah. I had another question. I was watching a video the other day. It was one of these ones by Alex Jones, and it was on the kind of dark side of the occult. And I was quite upset to see in one of his movies, he showed a copy of The Secret Doctrine, suggesting, like, Blavatsky's association with, like, Satanism or the dark side. And I guess partly that goes back. I'm not sure why he flashed this picture of The Secret Doctrine in this movie, and I thought, my God, you think Madame Blavatsky was on the dark side? And then I've heard people say, well, she had a magazine that was called Lucifer. So I wonder if you could say something about that issue, and what was Lucifer to Blavatsky? Why did she call her
Lucifer? Lucifer was the name that she gave to one of her magazines that she published in England. And the whole idea of Lucifer in its origin is the light bearer.
Yeah.
Of course, in certain theologies, Lucifer was demonized.
Yeah.
But in its origin, and certainly in some literary works, the nature of Lucifer is not so evil as we would understand it in contemporary theology. For example, Milton's Lucifer was much more human than the Lucifer of theology. So what she was using the term Lucifer was the light bearer.
Yeah.
From that word, from that root, lus, or for lux, which means light.
Yeah,
that was
the lux,
illumines
yeah.
every subject.
Yeah.
And that was her terms, not in association with any evil or dark occult practice. Now, she did say that occult powers and faculties were very real, and that without knowledge, or one who had not purified their own nature to a certain degree, if they had access to these faculties and powers, they could misuse those powers in a dark way, so to speak. And this was one of her warnings about our current time. You asked about the 20th century. Our times, and she said, not only would we see an up psychic nature of our humanity, but if we were not careful, the psychic capacities would outrun the intellectual and reasoning nature of our minds. And this was one of the reasons she brought forth the philosophy, so people would be aware of these faculties, understand them, and when they did appear, and try to put them in the right context.
Yeah.
So she was very much aware of the uses to which these faculties could be used in the wrong way.
Yeah.
And warned against that.
Yeah, it was interesting. I had these questions, so I went on the internet and did a little research on it, and I came up with some writing from the letters of H.P. Blavatsky, and this was written in, I think, 1890 when she was living in London, and she wrote to her sister, "We are about to found a magazine of our own, Lucifer. Don't allow yourself to be frightened. It is not the devil into which the Catholics have falsified the name of the Morning Star, sacred to all the ancient world, of the bringer of light." And then she goes on, she says a little further in this letter, "A whole society of Catholic clergy and high church fanatics have been formed here against your sister." She was talking, I guess she had a very strong reaction from the established churches to her work. They have already had three meetings. During the first, they tried to prove that I am no more and no less than the very devil in petticoats." I thought that was cute. "But my theosophist protested, and having asked for the right of speech, proved very neatly on the spot that these Catholics were Jesuits, sorry Christians, worshippers of Baal and Mammon. During the second meeting, they tried to take up the old story. She is a spy, an agent of the Russian government, and is dangerous to British interests." Here arose Lane Fox, Sinnott, and Sir Grove, and proved to the public that the enemies of theosophy who fear my Russian patriotism are near relatives to Balaam's ass. though it saw an angel at least and could talk, and they see only small blue devils everywhere in their bigotry, and I can't speak into the bargain. She's a remarkable writer, as I say.
Well, she was reminding us that many of the words and terms we use today are distortions, changes, degenerations from their original use and meaning. And, of course, that term Lucifer, the light bearer, the morning star, the name for Venus, was one of the points she was trying to make. And much of her work was to reestablish the reputations not only of certain human beings who were brave enough in earlier times to put forth some of these ideas, but to correct our own notions about different ideas. So reincarnation in one form was taught in the earliest centuries of Christianity. And even throughout its history in the last 2,000 years, there have been various Christian sects that believed in reincarnation and taught it. Same way in Judaism as well. That idea is very prevalent. So in that sense, her magazine was a light bearer trying to challenge our existing notions with the light of truth. Now, what she was doing at that time that seems so revolutionary and seemed to kick up a lot of dust and fuss, today we would all hail as terrific. Because we like to see a challenged authorities that go put themselves forward as knowing everything. We like to see them challenged in the sense of trying to find out what the truth is,
yeah,
and not just accept something. But she was doing it at a time when people tended to be more passive and not willing to investigate things for themselves in general. And that was one of the marks she said that we would see in the 20th century, that the individual themselves would begin to become their own authorities and begin to question and challenge the doctrines of the scientists and the religious leaders and so forth.
Yeah, I love the motto of the Theosophical Society, the one, there is no religion higher than truth.
There is no religion higher than truth. There is no science higher than truth. Truth itself is a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy, so there cannot be anything higher than it.
Yeah.
If we follow those disciplines, it's going to lead us to truth.
Yeah.
You know, the truth in the Greek comes from the phrase no forgetting, so that's kind of consistent with the whole of her work, really, is no forgetting, is that she's a vehicle for the remembrance of the entire cosmic unfolding, in the sense that she remembers it all, like right back to the very beginning and to the nothingness itself. It's remarkable in a sense that really is in keeping with her entire body of work.
Yeah.
Studying her works, in a sense, is an educational process in the true sense. That term education, or educare, to bring out,
to
uncover, to recall, to remember, the experience of the past. And one of the remarkable aspects of studying her teachings from time to time, and we see it repeated again and again, is as students look into these ideas, they become, in a sense, their own authorities. The teachings lead them to a self-realization of these truths rather than depending on external authorities.
Yeah.
Or information.
Yeah. Yeah, Blavatsky was so against dogma in any form, religious dogma,
science, dogmatism in science, dogmatism in any area for that.
Yeah.
She was truly a skeptical inquirer into everything, like the truth into the inquiry into religion and science, and just mm-hmm. as you say, so that you could eventually realize it yourself rather than relying on external authority or something that's been passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
But she reminds us that we can be open-minded and inquire into every area, but not for a moment to assume in our pride, in our modern pride, that we are the first human beings in history to have done this.
Yeah.
That for ages there have been serious inquiring minds who really wanted to get at the heart of truth. So why not, in our search, take advantage of what they discovered and begin to check and test and verify that, if we can, while we're searching for ourselves in our modern times for truth. There should be an agreement. The truth is truth, regardless of what age. So there should be agreement between what was known to be true in ancient times and what is true today.
Yeah.
So it's a great tutor in helping us approach our world of knowledge today.
I noticed we're coming down to, we just have a few minutes left here, Stephen. Thank you very much for being on today.
And
I look forward to meeting you in 2 weeks' time. We'll be in Petaluma, California. That's going to be quite something.
Same here. I look forward to that pleasure as well.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay. We just got a minute or two here, Jim.
Yes.
Any final thoughts? Boy, it just astonishes me. The more you delve into Blavatsky, it's like this vast realm of knowledge and insight and all this knowledge which has kind of been lost. Like, it's like she somehow gathered this ancient knowledge from all these different traditions and tried to synthesize it into a whole.
Yeah.
And it's so sad in a way that her scholarship, like, you look at her scholarship, it's beyond any contemporary philosopher, psychologist, scientist, eh? I mean, who has the kind of extensive work and knowledge of Blavatsky? No one's comparable.
Yeah, and I'd say the same about Gurdjieff, is that there's such wealth of information, and I guess the encouraging thing is that there's two figures in and of themselves, both who are like these giants who've appeared in the last 125 years. So there's, you know, there are people out there who are, you know, still coming to us and providing us with this insight. And like this stuff will be studied, you know, 1,000 years from now, just as this Gurdjieff's work will be. And I hope we're in a time when people will wake up to the fact that a lot of the problems and the mysteries that confront us are, you know, that they're important answers or important maps for us to follow and to try to figure these things out. And that, you know, that this is serious business, and that we should overcome our prejudices about what we know and what we don't know, and try to investigate these ideas with an open mind and an open heart.
Yeah. Yeah, Blavatsky so typified that in her work.
Yeah, I like what Stephen said, too. It's just that, you know, in terms of modern thought, you'd think that until 300 years ago that people were just stumbling around like a bunch of morons because they didn't have science, you know? Like, that's a completely idiotic point of view on the history of humanity, you know, that this has been going on for thousands and maybe millions of years, that you know, people have been searching to understand who we are and what we are and what we're here for, and that we should really try to you know, not dismiss this, but to try to know our past, because there's this heroic efforts there by these amazing people, you know, and it's...
Blavatsky was heroic in what she did in mining that ancient wisdom and bringing it forward into modern times.
Yeah, truly remarkable. I mean, as Stephen said, people didn't question things. Well, women certainly didn't play that role. That's more remarkable that she was a woman, that she did all these things, right? Like,
really in her time.
Oh, it's just amazing, you know?
Yeah. Well, Manly Hall describes the secret doctrine as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world.
Yeah.
I like to call Blavatsky a holy world star, distinguish her from like a Hollywood star.
Sorry, that went right over my head. Yeah, that's good. A holy world instead of
Hollywood, you know, real substance.
Yeah, she's no Lindsay Lohan.
Instead of deception. Anyway, okay, I think we're up on 6 and they're probably going to wind up. So I guess we'll well, I'll speak to you before, but you won't be back on the show. I don't think we can manage it next time,
yeah.
And you'll be back in two shows from
I'm
now,
I'm being
Jim.
Banished to the sidelines, but I'll be listening from, I'm looking forward to hearing from the conference in Petaluma, and sounds like it'll be great. I'm really looking forward to hearing about it.
Yeah, and the final message, anyone for information about the conference, go to www.theosophysandiego.org, I think.
Or, and I think it's www.blavatsky.net, too. I think they have stuff there, too. So yeah.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.